All right, so before we get started today, I'm guessing there are probably more questions out there about what you have due tomorrow. So what kind of questions do you have about what you have due tomorrow? What do you have to do tomorrow, just to make sure we're all on the same page? Final report and presentation for our list, both due by 5 p.m. So again, make sure you allow yourself some time to upload your presentation video. All right, to create your account if you don't have one, and that kind of stuff. All right. There are no questions. I just want to point you guys to a few things, remind you about a few things that are available to you to help along with that process. A little bit too big. On our website. First thing. There is a project handout for every one of these. It's been up since January. On one of the later pages of all those project handouts is a suggested outline that has some information about what needs to go where. So if you're, you know, hopefully at this point, since you've met with us and discussed it, you have a good idea, but in later reports, that's going to be true too. In the final project, you're going to have reports to write, the outline is there. All right? Right? There is also this pre-submission checklist. Please review this. I think it's probably helpful for you to review this before you even start writing stuff, generally. It's basically a summary of all the technical writing, technical communication points we've talked through in lecture. And really the first list we look through when we get reports from you guys. Okay. So don't make these mistakes, basically. This is a nice, easy check for you, laid out in checklist. There's a boxes there for you to physically check off if you want to print a copy and go through your report. Okay. This is what we're looking at, first and foremost. First, read through the report. This is it. Okay. There is also information on this guy about your presentation. So it's kind of pre-submission for presentation and document. Presentation video, where to post it. There is link from there and also link from our class website, video presentation guidelines. Okay. Another PDF that's here. It has information about how to submit, some example presentations that follow a certain format. Okay. Other specifications. So the specs, all the information you guys need is there. Just a reminder that we're trying to give you as much as we can to help you out. And kind of along those lines, there's 42 megabytes of example reports of varying quality, so you can see how it stacks up. Make sure if you're looking for good examples, you look in the folder that is good examples. Okay. And then we also have, if you're trying to remember what we talked about in technical writing and presentations, there are two video presentations, which are examples in the presentation document of how to do a kind of slide voiceover type presentation. So you have those, but then of course, hopefully you all know that we post the notes and audio from just about every lecture. It's there as well. So just a reminder about most of that stuff, hopefully. Hopefully you've seen all that before or knew about it. This next section, week from today, this is going to become a lot more relevant to what you're working on. So a week from today, we're going to start talking about how to program your kit that you brought. Okay. You don't need to bring your kit with you a week from today. So not until the following week, which is kind of after Mardi Gras, right? We'll start working through the kit. If you have, at that point in time, and we'll remind you leading into that exact lecture and that series of lectures, if you have a laptop, feel free to bring it. We'll let you, you know, we'll encourage you to crack it open and follow along with us as we're actually programming. If you don't have a laptop, not really a big deal, but make sure you make a friend in here and are actually looking over their shoulder and contributing. Okay. So we'll talk through how to use your kit, both what you purchased, and then eventually work up to the components we're going to give you as well. Okay. How many of you guys have written any code before? Okay. So we'll have a little short survey. That's a little bit higher percentage than normal, actually, so that will help having some experience around. But we're not assuming that you guys are coming into this with any program experience at all. So actually the lecture a week from today, the reason you don't need your kit is we're talking really core concepts. All right. on Tuesday, you're actually going to find out about the final project. So the final project teams, details, we'll discuss them. It's pretty much the whole lecture on Tuesday. Our time together on Tuesday will be dedicated to talking through that and laying out the schedule for that for the remainder of the semester, which you can already get a feel for by looking at the class schedule. All right. So going to get into your final team, and then from here on out, you're on that team. That's the remainder of the semester is lining us up for that final project, more or less, starting next week. That all sound cool? Okay. Questions about any of that? I don't know how administrative stuff's going to lay out from here on out. Does anybody not have a kit yet? It's okay. I just want to know. Okay.
I'm waiting on
email. Okay. So, yeah, make sure... You know, it's got still 2 weeks. Make sure it gets here if you can. They're usually pretty, the Spark Fund's usually really good about giving tracking numbers and that kind of thing, so might want to check on it. Okay. All right, so before we get into our short pair of lectures for today, what do you guys think of that toothbrush? It's pretty cool. What about it was pretty cool? The switch. What about the switch is pretty cool? How simple it was, right? It's a pretty simple mechanism. And I know I talked with a large number of you, but what's driving that simplicity probably? The cost of manufacture probably more than anything, or ease of manufacture even, right? So yeah, a piece of plastic that's that switch, right, is probably cheaper than a true electrical switch. But it's also easier, and we'll talk a little bit more about that today, to just slap a piece of plastic in place as opposed to trying to solder up a real electrical switch, right? So there's probably more savings in the ease of manufacture than there is in actually the cost of the part. Right. What else is pretty cool that anybody thought was cool maybe? Yeah, right. So remember that rod is kind of moving in a circle. So you got two-dimensional output from really just a one-dimensional input, right? All you have was a rotational motion of one single cheap brush DC motor, and the 2D output of that, a clever mechanical design. Yes, sir?
I like how they used all the
space inside. Yeah, so the space was pretty well utilized, right? There wasn't a lot of wasted space in the toothbrush itself, which is important because it's got to fit in a hand, right? So you could do specs on what's a comfortable size for stuff that fits in your hand. Yes, sir? Right, so the basically the electrical connections of the battery motor circuit also serve structural purpose as well, right? They're the kind of spring that held the battery in place and make it way easier to manufacture, which I think, just like the switch, I think is probably even more important than the savings and costs as opposed to having wires and a spring and things. And again, I talked to a large number of you about this, but I think that's the key takeaway probably from that exercise, right? Is that you don't get to that toothbrush unless you're thinking about manufacture and assembly as a customer of that product from day one, right? I don't think you get to that toothbrush if you design a toothbrush and then start trying to figure out how you're going to make it. Cool. So today we're going to talk about really kind of two flavors of the same topic. And it's called design for X, where X is some theme or some kind of part of your design property. Right, so we'll talk first about design for safety, and then look probably pretty quickly about design for manufacturing assembly. And there are, even within the design process, where we want to think about these things from the very beginning, which we'll talk about designing safety into your product. Just like you don't get to that toothbrush if you're not thinking about manufacturing from the beginning. You don't get to truly safe products by slapping a warning label on at the end of the thing. Okay, that's not safety. So we'll talk about that first, and then we'll talk more about design for assembly and manufacture and how that integrates with our overall design process. Okay, so let's talk first, by my mouse, about design for safety. Okay. So we've talked a little bit about this before in that kind of every house of quality on the planet can start out having safe to use or not dangerous or something like that as a customer requirement. Right? And that's largely because basically everything is dangerous or could be used in a dangerous way. Right? So we have to think about, for the particular problem we're trying to solve, what does that danger mean in this context? What about this could be dangerous or is dangerous? Right. And then furthermore, is that danger balanced by some kind of utility that our product offers? Okay. Chainsaw is a pretty dangerous machine, but it also offers a lot of utility in return. And some of the utility is as a function of it being dangerous and being able to cut stuff. Right? So when you think about things in that kind of terms, and remember that, you know, if you're thinking about safety designing your product, anything is dangerous. Right? So when we think about designing for safety, we'll see that the phases of this process seem a little bit like our design process. Right? We need to understand the problem we're solving. We need to look at risk identification and estimation. So that's kind of specification type development exercise. When you're thinking about danger, right? What are the risks? How often do they happen? Right? What's the outcome if bad things start to happen? Right? Does someone just irritate their gums a little bit with my toothbrush? Or are they cutting their arm off with my chainsaw? Right? What's the actual outcome of a dangerous incident with this particular product? And then review kind of existing designs and things like that in the process. So concept evaluation. So this process, looking at it and looking at safety from this perspective, we want to make this an explicit process during our design process. Right? And this should happen during design, but it also could happen for existing designs within your company. Okay? Or looking at competitors' products. Okay? And this thing, like most of what we're doing, is kind of iterative. Right? You're always looking at new products, always trying to improve your product with respect to safety, functionality, things like that. We're going to talk largely about some guiding principles, matching those outlined in your book. And we'll talk through each of these over the next few slides. Okay. Probably the most important here is designing safety into the product. Right? That's where we want to focus our effort. We start thinking about safety from day one. Right? It is a customer requirement of ours. And we've defined what safety means as a customer requirement for this particular product we're designing, right? We're designing in safety. That's what we mean, right? And like I said a few minutes ago, this is not safety. Okay? Warning labels are not enough to make your product safe. How many of you guys actually read warning labels? Nobody, basically, right? You look at them occasionally. But you buy a new product, it's going to have a warning label on it probably. Right? I think most people don't read them. Okay? You also can't really rely on operator training or common sense. Okay? And this is particularly true in a legal sense. Right? You're an engineer, you're going to be designing stuff people use. Right? If they hurt themselves in a way that was foreseeable operation of your product, whether it was a common sense operation or not, you and your company could be liable for that. So we have to think about how can we make our product safe enough that someone that doesn't have any common sense or training or hasn't read the manual, all these things, could use it in a safe manner. Right? Furthermore, we want to modify. So if we have existing designs, we can modify them to make it safe when we're thinking about this procedure. Okay. So we'll give one example because I think it's a pretty cool operation, table saw. These are pretty dangerous machines. So this was the state of the art in table saw safety for a long time. Put a guard on it, try to keep people's fingers away. Okay. I'm guessing some of you have probably seen this particular product called SawStop. We'll take a look at a video about this guy if we can for a few minutes. It's a really great example of designing safety into the product. Let's stop there for a small dynamics aside. You guys have made it. You removed them for me. You guys made it through impulse momentum yet? Probably just learning right now, right? Usually around this time. Okay. So this guy just throws out a number, 1,000 G's it stops. How did you get to the actual number for the system? Was that?
1,000 G's acceleration.
Yeah, I mean, you're working from F equals MA. That's impulse momentum gets you there, right? But we have a blade spinning at a certain velocity, angular velocity, and you could get the kind of equivalent linear velocity of the endpoint, right? The exterior rim of that. It stops in a certain distance, right? That's impulse momentum. That's the definition of that, right? So we could get to the actual acceleration and then forces as a result necessary to stop that blade in that amount of time. Right? So he just throws out 1,000 G's. I'm not sure that this is that, but you could get to the actual, a ballpark estimation of the number with what you have already. Right? So when we talk about having numerical targets on specs, that's what we mean. Impulse momentum, that's an easy equation to just rough out for a system. And you guys have the skill to do that already. You don't have to pull 1,000 G's out of nowhere. You could get, oh, it should be between 500 and 1,500, depending on stopping distance. Right? And yeah, that's a pretty broad range, but it actually has some engineering analysis supporting it. Right? And you guys all have the skill to do that. Yeah. So this product, this has safety design into it. Right? And furthermore, what the safety becomes a critical differentiator from his competitors as well, for that company. Right? And you can do things on that safety front, right, that effectively make you or put you in a market leader position. I think the SolStop guy has kind of done that. Right? And you'll see a lot of makerspaces, a lot of universities, those kind of places don't have table saws without SolStop. Largely for safety reasons. Right. So design safety in your product. Here's another example of where we might want to do that. So this is an aerial lift. This was at an airport in Miami. So this guy goes up, and two guys were in here working on an antenna on the tail of an aircraft. So they went up in this aerial lift, and as they went up, it kind of fell over backwards. So we were working on this court case. I was an expert witness in this case. And it's critical that this is a 1977, I think it was, model of this particular truck and aerial lift. The next year, the regulations changed such that if these outriggers were not deployed, the basket wouldn't go up. Right? So the instructions were to operate this thing that you had to extend these outriggers. Increase your base of stability, support polygon, becomes more stable. These guys are not going to flip over. Okay? Of course, they each said they thought the other person did it, or maybe they were in a hurry or whatever. They didn't do that, and both got pretty banged up as a result. Okay? So it's very easy, actually, from an engineering standpoint, and that's why it's basically the law now, to design safety into this particular system. Right? I can just have a software check. I can actually have even a hardware switch in this case. It doesn't get triggered. I can't move any of the aerial lift components of this thing unless this is extended a certain amount. Okay? So now I'm designing safety into that product. That's what we mean. Right? I'm making it harder to operate this thing in an unsafe way. And in fact, a lot of aerial lifts now, the JLG, I think, are designed so that they're not unstable at all. Anywhere in their workspace, they're not going to flip over. Right? So that's about understanding the dynamics, essentially moment balance equations, about each tipping axis to make sure that I'm not going to go unstable. So I've designed now a truly stable and safe system. In that way, at least. Okay. A story about this one. So I worked another court case where accident case. These guys were in Boston, and they were working on the corner of a building, actually about 180 feet up around the corner of the building on one of these aerial lifts, and went to move away from the building a little bit, and then just kept going. So as you might imagine, from 180 feet up, one of those guys did not survive. One of the workers did survive. Was that, you know, so 180 feet you're harnessed in, This guy unharnessed on the way down, jumped on the roof of a building to survive. So, we're investigating this accident in this particular case, and the company says, hey, that this, our aerial lift, it can't get any of these configurations. Right? What we have are sensors that make sure that the arm's in the right place and we won't let you move into a position. So they had tried to design some safety into the product. And they had these sensors that were sensing the location of the arm and the load in the bucket and all these things. But what they had done was written the code, and we'll talk more about this in a second, such that there was a single point of failure in their code. If any of the sensors got erroneous readings, they stopped reading them all and started ignoring them all. So because these guys and that company, as the girls at the company, had not really considered and not really looked at that product from a truly safety perspective, someone lost their life. Right? That's not a place you want to be as an engineer. Certainly not a place I want to be. Right? So we have a huge responsibility when we're designing products to think about safety. Okay? So this lecture, I think, is a really critical one to the progress of your career. Okay? So let's continue a little bit. Okay. Next kind of topic we'll talk about is to utilize guards, right? There's kind of old school lawnmower, front of this bike, right? There's no guards on those guys. Right? You can get injured by that pretty easily. Look at a modern push mower, right? There's all kinds of parts on this that make it harder for someone to get to the dangerous bits of it. Right? It's harder to get your fingers in a place where they're going to get cut off on this lawnmower than it was that old real mower, right? Okay. Not impossible, but you have to make an effort to do it. Right? There are guards in place to prevent you from doing that, or try to prevent you from that. And like we saw, this table saw, that was one place we also saw that. Okay. We'll come back to the push mower in a minute. Another thing you need to do, we talked about you can't rely on your operator being trained well, right, or having common sense, is that we're going to make mistakes, right? And it's foreseeable that a user of your product is going to make a mistake. Okay? So people are making mistakes. People are going to be distracted when they're using your product, almost invariably, right? People are going to be tired, right? People are not going to read the operator's manual for your product, right? People are, even if they get training, they're not going to pay attention to it. Right? Or they're not going to remember it. They're going to skip it even. Right? Equipment's not going to be maintained properly, most likely. Okay? These are all things that are foreseeable uses of your product. Okay? People are going to be impaired when they use your product. Right? So we need to at least think about these things when we're designing products that people are using. Okay? And when you think about these things, right, these behaviors, you can't prevent them. And just go into it with that. Okay, well, if someone has not read the operator's manual, what does that mean for how they're going to operate our product? Okay? Someone's not paying attention. What does that mean for how they're going to operate our product, and how much danger does it then put them in? So if you go down this list of things and you think about each one of these as you're designing the product, as you're evaluating maybe competitors in the market, okay, we need to address these points. And the bigger point here is that even thinking about these things right now, right, someone still can get injured, right? But by thinking about these things and designing your product and trying to accommodate as much of this as we can, right, you're just going to make the product better, right? If someone can operate your product, even if it's really complex, without needing to read the user manual, is that a better or worse product? It's better, right? Right? Someone doesn't need any special training to use your product. Is that a better product or a worse product? It's better, right? So thinking about this from an operator perspective, right, it's just going to make the product better. Right? It's going to make it safer, and then it's even going to make it better for the people that are doing it the right way. okay, that aren't drunk. All right? Speaking of that, I always think this is pretty funny. This guy has a business, side business. He'll test your website for you. Drunk. You see how it works? Yes, people can use it while they're drunk. Okay? Kind of interesting. Business model, I guess. Probably not so good for the liver. So here's another story. So this is Boeing's Everett factory in Everett, Washington. So this is, for a long time, was the largest building in the world by volume. Huge place. Right, these are 767s, I think, over here. Right? So big, huge place. And you see all this railing on top. Most of it actually is accessible via bridge crane. So that's kind of where we were there. We're doing some installations of the crane control stuff you saw on the first day of lecture. So they could pick a part up in one corner of this big, huge building and go down. And there are actually places you can cross over between columns. So you can see one there. Right. Like, I could pick something up in one corner of this building and crane it all the way to the other if I wanted to. Mostly what they do, however, is move parts along kind of each column. So you see each of the kind of columns kind of a airplane assembly line almost. So we were there, and they were telling us stories. We were there. We wanted to make the cranes faster because we can do that. Like, no, 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 no. We want them to be safer. That's their primary interest in what we were doing for them. So they're telling us, of course, safety stories. They're telling us a story about one of their crane operators. These cranes are overhead, right? So this is, you know, pretty good height. And you actually ride in the trolley of these cranes. And generally looking kind of between your legs, and you have levers on either side of your chair. Okay. And the cranes are not so fast, and this is a long ways. So if you're moving a part from one, the kind of the top of the column to the other side, it takes quite a while to get there. So they tell us a story. This guy has a multi-million dollar part, is in the crane, puts on the gas, and it's kind of chucking along the end. And you guys probably can predict what happens. What do you think happens? He falls asleep, exactly. Falls asleep, weight's still on the lever, slams the thing into the end of the building. Right? So this is a professionally trained crane operator, right? Right? Didn't get enough sleep the night before or whatever. Fell asleep. Millions of dollars, right, gone. Okay. So there's a few things to that thing. A few things about that story I want to point out. One is you're even professionally trained, highly skilled operators are going to make mistakes and have bad days. Right. The other part is that crane system at Boeing did not have safety designed into it. So one thing we did for them was add actual limit switches to prevent someone from running into the end of the building. They just had hard mechanical stops at the end of their crane. So we have laser distance sensors there now, tell you how far the bridge is from the building. We'll slow it down and stop it nice and easy. Okay. So we can design safety into that crane that would have prevented that accident from being as big a deal as it was, right? Even in the presence of operator error. Okay. Another crane accident. I can probably predict what's going to happen on this one already. Cranes, this is a boom crane, have load charts inside that tell you how heavy a load you can pick up at what boom angle. Right? The crane operator is supposed to look at that chart and be able to figure out what I can pick up and how far away from me I can set it down. Now I'm lowering the boom a little bit, right, which is increasing that moment arm of that mass. And there we go. That's a bad day. Okay. So what you'll see increasingly in these boom cranes of this style, right, is some information that's going to providing back to the operator that won't let them lower the boom into configuration using some knowledge of the load that's on the boom at that time. Right? But doesn't exist in practice right now. So we could design more safety in this boom to prevent accidents like that one. Okay. Excuse me. What about using guards? We also want to try to restrict improper use. People are going to try to use the thing in an improper way. We want to try to restrict that and make it so the ways that they can use it improperly and injure themselves as a result are limited as much as possible. Okay. So what do we have to do to use this push mower? I got to pull that lever. Okay. What do people do with that lever? Tape it, tie it down, zip tie it, whatever. Right? So we've tried to prevent people from using this thing in an unsafe way. Right? Of course, they're still going to do that. Right? But we've made it one step harder. Right? So we still have designed some safety into this product. Right? We did something similar. I'll go through this quickly. We had this boat control project. So any of these guys, I need to show the video. But basically, we designed our remote control system, and most industrial control systems are designed the same way, where you have to have your hand on a button to control the joystick at all time. So just pushing forward on the joystick doesn't do much by itself. Right? Reason being, if I drop that joystick and it gets lays upside down and the joystick's forward, the thing's not taking off. So it takes kind of two actions together to make that, right? And that's kind of all given the point here. Basically, you want to make it hard for the user to accidentally operate in an unsafe way, right? They're going to operate in an unsafe way. Make them have to want to do it in the unsafe way, right? And take additional steps beyond normal operation to make that possible. So again, you want to accommodate these operating conditions, right? I saw a video, I couldn't find it when I was looking for it the other day. Someone using a push mower. Had the thing zip tied and were holding up and trimming their hedges with it. I think I've seen that one too, right? So yeah, we've tried to make that push mower safer. And I think it is safer than those old style reel mowers. But people are going to do things in a dangerous way, right? The point that you have to take into consideration as an engineer, is there a way that I can make this product still maximize its utility for its intended purpose and safer at the same time, right? Make someone have to make a really intentional effort to use it in an unsafe way, right? Talked already about utilizing redundancy, about that aero lift in Boston. This is another good example, right? The extra tires on heavy trucks. Okay. Another one I talk about is designing safe failure modes into your product. There's a segue, probably one of the most important people in computing history there. Writing a segue. Segues are pretty cool engineering products, but probably one of the worst products of all time from a sales perspective. Never made any money. What's the problem with a segue from a safety perspective? You guys have ideas? Pretty hard to stop it. What else? It's easy to fall off. It can be. People can't control it.
It's all open.
Yeah, so. Right. So I think there's, you guys are all hinting at, yes, problems with this product. Right? The one let's talk first about, and it's kind of, I'm giving it away with the slide title here. If anything goes wrong with this segue, what happens to it? The segue stops working. What happens to the person standing on top of it? Right? So it's an inverted pendulum. So that's really an unstable system. There's no safe failure mode for a segue. Anything goes wrong at all, that segue is going over. Quite possibly with you on it. Okay? So that's one of the fundamental safety failures of the segue. Is it has to work perfectly all the time for this thing to be a safe product. There's a lot of really cool engineering that goes into designing and controlling a Segway, But that one fundamental fact is what has made it a, well, not the only one, but one that has made it a failure as a product. Right? And making tons and tons and tons of people to get hurt all the time on Segways. So for example, right, in this case, right, I have to be able to control both of those wheels exactly, right, to balance that rider. So I hit a patch that, like, go off the sidewalk a little bit, and I hit a little bit of mud or something. That one wheel spins. I have no way to know that wheel is spinning or whether it's actually on the sidewalk and moving forward. Segway doesn't know that, right? And I have to be able to control both of them to keep me upright. So what happens is someone gets dumped off. What often happens in that case, you know, you're going down a sidewalk, you're going tourism, you know, some kind of tour, worked the case in San Francisco, some sand on the sidewalk. That could be enough for the system, one of those wheels to kind of spin out, and now my Segway is not balanced anymore. And off you go. Right? Another common injury for these guys, there's no real safe way for me to escape. So there's no safe failure mode of the device. There's really no great way for the person that's using it to get out of the way when things go wrong either. So one common injury here, so you can kind of see, so I have these big wheels on either side, and all the newer models have this kind of big hump in the middle too. Okay, and then your feet go on either side. Like so. Okay. So imagine I'm going on a sidewalk and one of my wheels happens to hit some sand. What happens to the base of my Segway now? I just twist. In that scenario, how easy is it going to be to get your feet out of that thing? Not very easy. So what you end up with is a lot of people that might get one foot out, and the other one happens to stay in, while this 86-pound Segway that can do 12.5 miles an hour wants to rotate at full speed. So you get spiral fractures of tibia and fibula that seem pretty painful. Right. So there's cool engineering that goes into this, but it's not a safe product, and I pretty much argue not a very good product. Okay. You guys ridden a Segway? One? They're pretty fun. It's fun. And they're good. Yes, sir.
So how do you feel about the hoverboards that don't get
Yeah, right. So there are a few things, right? There's a few things that make those different than a Segway, I think, in some fundamental ways. Okay, I just said a minute ago, this Segway weighs, the kind of base model is 86 pounds, I think it is. Right? And they can do 12.5 miles an hour. So, and it can accelerate even beyond that, around that 12.5 miles an hour, because it has to have a high acceleration rate to be able to balance you once you start falling over, right? So you guys can do the math on that, right? You can do the kinetic energy, convert to the right units and such, 1/2 mv². I have a huge amount of kinetic energy in this thing that's just waiting to break somebody, basically, right? So as a result, one of the injuries you also see is when you get on it, it's kind of hard to balance, certainly when you first start learning, right? And if you step off the back and hold onto the handlebars, right? The handlebars come back, what does the Segway think? It thinks you're falling backwards, so it's going to try to accelerate backwards to catch you. So people step off the back, and you got an 86-pound machine coming at full acceleration right into your shins. So you end up with broken shins. That's another really common injury. Okay. So the hoverboards are better in what way than that? Okay. They don't have much mass. They tend to be a little bit slower. You can get out of the way easier, right? There's less trouble in me getting off of the thing, okay? The other thing to think about it from an energy perspective, what's the potential energy due to gravity? Something to do with the height of the ground. Right? Generally, we say it's mgh. So it's the mass times gravitational constant times the height off the ground. So we have a person, right? That's not changing. This height, how high are you on the ground on a subway compared to one of the hoverboards? Hoverboards are much lower to the ground, actually, right? So you also have a lower potential energy from you just being up off the ground, right? And that difference actually gets you back into a region where it's much harder to actually break stuff, bones and such. It's kind of that critical crossover part between those hoverboards and a Segway. So they're a bit safer, actually, if you can prevent it from catching on fire. Which is a different problem. Okay. So, let's move on. If your product is going to need maintenance to be able to operate correctly, you better make that maintenance super, super, super easy to do. Otherwise, people are not going to do it. Even if it is really easy to do, people are probably not going to do it. Yeah. So you look, for example, at kind of old cars. These engines needed a lot of maintenance, needed a lot of attention. Right? They're a little bit simpler than modern engine, but one reason they are is that it needed repair. Right? So things were made easy to repair. Right? So this is an old Corvette engine. You look at a modern Corvette engine, it looks like this. Right? It's not really intended, right, for the driver, the owner, to really do a lot of maintenance on that engine any longer. Right? Same thing with kind of old computers. There's an Apple One, or is it an Apple Two? Maybe Apple Two. Old computer needed a lot of maintenance. Right? You actually had to fiddle with it to make it work quite often. Right? So this facilitated that maintenance. That was part of the product design, making it easy to change cards out and things like that as you need it. Modern computers, here's the inside of the most recent MacBook, a really tiny one. It's actually all battery. Right? This is not intended for the actual user to do anything inside of. So if you need maintenance, you got to make it as easy as possible. And even then, people are probably not going to do it. Right? You do all those things, try to design some safety into your system, then you think about, okay, what do I really need to warn the user against? And there's some systems that are still going to be dangerous. So, for example, our broom crane example. I still would want to warn the user. Even if I'm going to let them know, I can't lower the boom any farther, you're going to flip over, I need to probably notify the user that there's some reason I'm prohibiting that information. Right? So, actually, a cockpit's a really good example of this. Airplanes are a dangerous system. Right? It's inherently dangerous. So, there's a lot of information here. And we are relying a little bit on the skill of our operators. But they need a lot of information. They need to know when things are going wrong so that hopefully they can help fix it. And then once you have those kind of warning systems in place, you're probably still going to have all these warning labels on your product. I don't think the law side of your company is going to let you get away without that. And in fact, some of these are mandated by law, right? Okay, questions about designing for safety. Excuse me.
So are we just witnessing those court cases?
So the question was about the court cases. Yeah, I've been an expert witness in a number of court cases, so some crane accident ones, a few aerial lifts. Actually, kind of assistant expert witness to my PhD advisor at Georgia Tech for the first major Segway lawsuit. Yeah, so they'll come and ask, and faculty end up doing a bit of that work if you're interested in it. Accident reconstruction. I know dynamics, basically. So I can map out the forces at play and things like that in a crane accident or in a Segway accident. And oftentimes, starting with the stuff you guys, you know, you said you just learned impulse momentum, that gives you what kind of force does a Segway at a certain speed have when it rams into your leg at full speed. Is that enough to break a bone? Yeah, turns out, yeah.